bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. It appears the clock is ticking down on France being able to take advantage of Niger from colonial tax that Niger has been paying the French treasury to usurping the country's natural resources. There seems to be a new game in town after Niger's July 26 coup. Nigerians are asking for the French to leave their country, from the French ambassador to the 1,500 French troops on the ground there. The ruling military leaders want to see the French out of the country. However, it's a difficult choice for Paris, as Niamey has continued to help fill the French treasury with its wealth. Can Niger hold on and exert its sovereignty to bring about a change needed for this country to have a better future? We'll be looking at all of this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guest still now to the program. Netta Freeman, coordinating committee member of the Black Alliance for Peace out of Washington, D.C. And Jeff Brown, geopolitical analyst out of Chicago. Welcome, both of you. Thanks so much for being with me. Well, let's start it off with NAFTA in D.C. What is your assessment so far of the rulers of Niger since the coup?
Well, the people that have taken over have taken a pretty anti-imperialist position, and definitely anti-French imperialism at the very least. And it is in line with clearly the sentiments of the people, because the people are in the streets cheering on this anti-French and what we would refer to as the decolonization or the de-new colonization of Niger and in all its colonies. And I think it's to me, it's also something promising. It says something for a unity of Africa, that some of the countries like Mali and Burkina Faso have pledged to come to the assistance in the event of a military invasion. I think it says something about the leadership, that they have rejected all inferences to stay under the thumb of the Western powers, and particularly particularly France, and that they didn't expect, or that France and other powers didn't expect, for ECOWAS to have to back down in terms of this, at least the participation in a military operation. But ECOWAS as a regional body seems to be working for the interest of the colonizers, neo-colonizers.
Okay, well, Jeff, Paris says it won't recognize the coup and that it was illegal and carried out against a democratically elected government. But isn't this ironic for the French to say that when Paris and other Western countries have for decades overthrown democratically elected African leaders, killed them, and supported coups and dictatorships?
Yes, in fact,
go ahead, Jeff.
In fact, France does not deny assassinating 22 African presidents, national leaders. This is the president who was deposed is a puppet of Paris. All of the president, the government in Mali and Burkina Faso and Gabon and Central African Republic and Chad, all of these governments were stooges of the West, of NATO, et cetera. So they can call it illegal, but of course any revolution is considered to be illegal in the eyes of the elites. I mean, the Iranian revolution was considered illegal in the eyes of the West. So it's basically, you know, to me it's the pot calling the kettle black, and it's really irrelevant that France says that. They of course want their puppet president back in power so that they can continue to rape and pillage the country. Okay. I would like to point out that. Go ahead. No, you go on. Next.
No, go ahead. You want to make a point? Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to point out that for 70 years, these countries have been supposedly getting aid and help from the West, and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and Europe and the European Commission, et cetera. Yet after 70 years, they all are 20% of them have electricity, 20% of them have running water, 20% of them have plumbing. The literacy rate is somewhere between 20% and 40%. Infrastructure has barely been built over the last 70 years, except to carry out, haul off the natural resources that the West is exploiting.
Right, we're going to get into that a little bit more, Jeff. Stay with me. Well, NAFTA, right. The French ambassador has been asked to leave the country, and even supplies as well as water and electricity have been cut off. The ambassador refuses to leave. Your assessment of this, it seems very imperialistic way of how they're dealing with this. And is it that really? Because Paris knows that in the long run, it can't afford, in its own imperialistic perspective, to let Niger go in that way. I mean, how do you see it?
I mean, that's exactly right. Because of the fact that ECOWAS also failed at even convincing the leaders of the takeover to acquiesce, and that they even started talking about, you know, putting in positions of some sort of transition to a civilian government in 9 months or something like that. But any of that for France means a threat, the jeopardizing of its neocolonial disposition. One of the other guests was about to outline all of the ways in which the France and the neocolonizers, but even France, seems to posit itself as this benefactor to the African countries. But in fact, what we're probably going to get to is the fact that the uranium of Niger and other natural resources, but the uranium in particular powers a lot of Europe, a lot of France. It also serves to help in the construction of nuclear weapons and all these kind of things. And so they can't, with all of the other countries falling, you know, and kicking out France, Niger had to be a line in the sand. They don't really know what else to do. What I'm concerned about, and what we should also be concerned about, is that without them being able to use, even though they're not able to use a black, what we would call imperialism in blackface with these regional bodies, to do a military invasion, it still is not beneath them to do it. They are desperate, and for them, the decolonization represents a death as they know it, or, you know, the non-existence of they know it. So they're not beyond invading. They even tried it, and then Algeria rejected them. They're using their airspace, and so it's a dangerous situation that we're in right now.
Right, right. Well, Jeff, you were pointing out some of the ways that France has been exploiting Niger and other African countries. I want to look at some of this because we know that Niger gained its independence allegedly or supposedly from France in 1960. But the reality is that France has basically been sucking it dry. Of course, the colonial tax is one way, with 85% of the revenue, not only from, of course, Niger, but we know other countries that France has been exploiting, and 85% of the revenue being deposited in French central bank. I want to look at how this has affected that country. You were pointing out some issues as far as education and the overall development of these countries, but I'd like for you to expand on that now.
Well, I've traveled in most of the countries in West Africa, and they are huge. They have they're like the size of Texas several times. They're like the size of Alaska. They're massively huge countries, and with very, very poor infrastructure. And so in and 150 years of colonialism, France and Britain, for that matter, in East Africa, it's no different, only built the infrastructure that was useful and to haul off all of the resources. So all these countries got their official independence in the late 50s, early 60s, and they got a flag, and they got a seat at the UN, but they were still completely under the control of France. And it's not just France; it's also Britain and East Africa, and the United States, all over Africa. They're not really independent. And although the French colonies are some of the worst because of the currency that they were forced to take on after independence in the 60s, the CFA franc. And so the people are sick of it. They're just there has not been any improvement in their lives in 70 years, and the people are just tired of it and they're standing up. I wrote an article recently where I said that in 4 years, Thomas Sankara, the communist leader in Burkina Faso, in 82 to 87, something like that. In those 4 years, he built more roads, more hospitals, more schools, more bridges, and more infrastructure to help the people in those 4 years, and also increase literacy dramatically, than France ever did all across West Africa in 150 years.
And that's why he was assassinated, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Of course, that's why he was assassinated. He was one of the 22 that they gunned down.
Right. I want to look at that NEDFA. If we look at, going back to the Berlin Conference in the 19th century, and this whole divide, how the Europeans felt that the African continent belonged to them and divided these countries, and how that has played in all of this, because we had natural allies. Kanja was one tribe or whatever, all of a sudden, arbitrary line to divide them, basically to keep the Africans from being united, to keep them divided. Are we looking at transcending that divide? When we see now, you mentioned earlier about Burkina Faso, you mentioned about Mali, and the solidarity now that they have with Niger. Do you think that we're getting to that point where that African unity is becoming more of a priority for Africans?
Yeah, I think that's what's happening. I think it's actually a material requirement for survival. Because with the neoliberal agenda dominating the global economy, and that also those who are trying to enforce that neoliberal agenda have resorted to things that are really destroying the planet, and that the increasingly economic disparity and the poverty and the polar the poverty and everything, and the fact is all making people realize we have to unite. One of the things I think imperialism does, and the rulers of imperialism do, is they underestimate, because they also think of, and we know we have, we refer to the lack of formal education that people have, illiteracy and whatnot, but that doesn't mean people aren't aware of something and that we can't transfer information. They underestimate the impact of hindsight. That France, led by the U.S. and NATO, all of them, they destroyed Libya. It was the destruction of Libya in 2011 and the Libyan Jamhuriya that was actually trying to do something good for the continent of Africa. That destruction of Libya was also what dispersed the violent extremism that's across the continent, that's even affecting Burkina Faso and Mali, and that with the French Foreign Legion and the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM, their military, uses as an excuse to be in these countries and has failed miserably in trying to stave this off. So you see a younger generation, and then we have to talk about Burkina Faso, I think, and this hindsight thing, because we also the legacy of Thomas Sankara, the legacy even in the Congo of knowing about Patrice Lumumba. You don't have to have a whole lot of formal education. These things have reverberations that the imperialism underestimates. So before these coups happened, there were young people, like if you think of Congo, they were actually doing political education work, and that now these other people who have assumed positions in the military, while they may be trained by AFRICOM and the French Foreign Legion and whatnot, it doesn't mean there isn't other things in that are impacting also their mentality and what their considerations are. So we're seeing things coming to a head, I think.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Jeff, you heard Netva just talk about the French forces and American forces that are on the continent. I want to look at that in Niger, because we know that the French have at least 1,500 troops on the ground there, and the U.S. also has troops on the ground there, and they say that they are fighting insurgency and terrorism. Now, the new government in Niger is saying that they're the source of a lot of this instability and terrorism. Your thoughts on that?
Well, this goes back to Afghanistan. This goes back to Afghanistan in the 1990s, shipping out all of these extremist groups, Al-Qaeda and all the others across Africa, the West Asia, the Middle East, Asia, and even in Russia, et cetera. All of these are financed, supplied, trained by NATO. They have, the group, was it Boko Haram in Nigeria? Yeah, Boko Haram. Now they got brand new trucks and brand new machine guns, and this is all being paid for by NATO. They want to create chaos because it creates a perceived need to be saved by the West. And Burkina Faso, at least Burkina Faso for sure, and I think Niger have just come out and said it. I mean, the French have been there now for 9 or 10 years. They were there making sure that there were terrorist attacks so that they could justify staying in West Africa. So as far as I'm concerned, Al-Qaeda and all the other offshoots all across the world, they're just subsets of the CIA and NATO. That's a fact.
Well, Netva, Niger is trying to flex its muscle and have changed now the price of uranium that it sells to match international markets. I have to say I'm enjoying this, to be honest. And as opposed to what the French have been paying, the market price of uranium is around 200 euros per kilo. Niger had been selling uranium to France for 80 cents a kilo, less than 1 euro. I want to look at that, the level of exploitation, that it's quite unbelievable. And can I say the goal, even now, of using the word democracy and equality and human rights to try to justify this unbelievable exploitation?
Yeah, I mean, it is a goal. I mean, they have to even when they apply the word democracy, it really makes no sense. On the ground, you hear a lot of the population of the people, the analysts, I guess, on the ground refer to constitutional coups as a way to look at the contradiction or the hypocrisy in the West, saying, oh, you have to have this democratically elected government, what they call democratically elected, and turning a blind eye to those leaders who have changed the constitution and try to, change, make reforms that impose forms that would have them in for life or in have indefinitely be able to run for office. The hype, the super exploitation of the Africa and the resources goes on. It's a colonial legacy where the colonizers felt like this is our property. It even speaks to back, and you can think, remember back in King Leopold had of Belgium had the Congo as his own personal backyard, this whole country. And so that mentality has not gone anywhere ever, despite the fact of all the flowery language and things that they use to say what is the mission of the IMF and World Bank and all, or even the United Nations, which we see these bodies, and particularly the undemocratic nature of the United Nations, the Security Council, with all the Western powers being able to have veto votes on everything. But what I think is a promising thing, and I'll end on this, is that the world is waking up. There are all moves like the BRICS formation, like the G77 that goes back to reconstituting itself back from the time of the non-aligned movement, and the emerging multipolarity or counterbalance from China and Russia and other emerging economies that don't impose themselves on Africa, but are engaged in some type of bilateral agreement. And so this desperation, but anyway, I might be digressing from your original question, but the arrogance really is a colonial legacy.
Indeed. Well, Jeff, French originally said he would not talk to the new military government in Niger. However, the people on the ground have surrounded both the French embassy and the French military base. Now Paris has agreed to start the process of withdrawing its forces from the country. Your take on this, what does that mean, and do you think that they will actually do it?
I would like to support what my colleague just said, and I'll even go, it's just pure racism. This is just classical racism that goes back hundreds of years. It's nothing less than that. And so I just want to say that. I mean, colonialism, imperialism, capitalism are all founded on racism. And it's going to be interesting to see what they do. I think we need to bring up, you know, is France going to try to start talking to them? I think the fact that Mali and Burkina Faso are willing to send troops into Niger has probably, and the fact that Algeria is not cooperating with France, is making it extremely difficult for the French to try to do something militarily. ECOWAS, you know, I mean, we go back to the slave days in the United States. I mean, I look at ECOWAS as like the House Negroes, you know, who are a step above, you know, the poor slaves out on the plantation, you know, in Niger. I mean, ECOWAS is just a prostitute for NATO. And so they're an embarrassment. They're an embarrassment to the peoples of Africa. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. The 800-pound gorilla in all of this is the United States. We cannot forget that the United States has a massive footprint in Niger. They have a brand new $100 million drone port in Niger, and no one's talking about the United States, not even the Nigerian government. And it's going to be interesting. Obviously, they want to get rid of the French first, but at that point, are they going to be able to try, if they even can get the French out of there? And then after that, they still have several American bases with, I read an article, something like $500 million have been spent in Niger in the last 9 years by the United States. So they're not going to want, they're going to be hard to push out, and the French are too. It's not going to be easy. This is not Ho Chi Minh, people's war with jungles that they can hide in. This is vast desert. If anybody tries to approach the military bases, they can see them coming from kilometers away.
Okay.
It'd be extremely difficult to get the French and the Americans out.
Right. Netfa, 1 minute, final thoughts. Where do you see this going?
Ooh, it's hard to say where it's going. I don't think that we can say it's on. It still should be heartening, and we should be gratifying to see this type of anti-decolonization move, even though the war might be the end, and we don't want war, but we do have to stand up. It's a prerequisite to decolonization, and I do agree with a colleague that AFRICOM and the United States in general is the one we have to look at. They're actually the top dog of the U.S. EU NATO axis of domination, and I think they're playing their cards right not to talk about them right now, because once that goes on, then the U.S. will be forced to treat this much more hostile, and if we can avoid that, that's the best thing. But it would be nice if they would just do what they should do, the right thing, and leave and go home. But unfortunately, decolonization is a messy process.
Okay. And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Netfa Freeman, coordinating committee member of Black Alliance for Peace out of D.C. Jeff Brown, geopolitical analyst out of Chicago. Thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. See you next time.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. This is Back to Reality. I am Asma. I have the honor to be your host. And as for today, we have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita. Welcome to the studio, sisters.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure to be with both of you. And since it is the ritual in here for the guests to introduce themselves, I would like you to very much briefly introduce yourself and give us a little bit of background about yourself.
I am Zainab Askari, and I am actually from Indian administrated Kashmir, and I have been living in Iran for some 9 years now.
Yeah.
And before that, I have done master's in linguistics from Kashmir University, and then I joined Hausa in Qom.
Assalamu alaikum, my dear sisters and dear listeners. I am Bita, and again, I have the pleasure to be here with you too, especially our listeners. And I'm studying medicine in Tehran, and that's it.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
In whatever you're doing. There was a time in my life when I thought that, okay, all these difficulties that I'm facing are not going to end and there is no full stop for it. And then just for some days, you feel like your heart is getting crushed so heavily and then you cannot do anything for it. Like, you know, it happens in every one of our lives that for one day, for 1 week, for a month, for even longer than that, we feel like everything is just getting out of our control, and we're just, unfortunately, we get to think that we are left alone and nothing happens to change the situation. Nothing happens for my good and everything is against me. The entire world is my enemy. It's very difficult for us in those moments to just keep the moderation and the balance, which is the key point in our lives. It's very difficult in those moments to feel like, okay, there's going to be an end to it. I'm sure it has happened to you as well.
Yeah, it happened for sure. You know, I think these difficulties, I don't know, these darkness of everybody's life just are there for you. You know, it's a part of you. It's a part of life. So it's not like you just, maybe lie to yourself that, okay, no, life is beautiful. Life is la vie en rose. Life is that. Life is this. No, it's not like that. Life is not a kind of rainbow thing, you know. So life is not as beautiful as you think. It's the first step that you have to accept.
Exactly.
You know? And the other thing is that sometimes you are just get trapped in a positive feedback mechanism. What it is, you know, you cannot just make the balance of being happy and being sad, because when you are sad, you really think about your sadness. And this just thinking about your sadness will make you more sad and sadder.
Even sadder, yeah.
And this is exactly the same thing about happiness. You know, this is what we call it, the positive feedback loop, that it happens even in our body. You know, sometimes there are some chemicals that, you know, they are secreted from some parts of your body, and they will come back to that organ, and that will affect it to secrete more. And this is exactly what happens in our body and in our mind. Okay, and the only way to stop this actually mechanism is to realize that it is gonna end. As you mentioned this, you know, there is an end and a full stop for everything in this world. So,
exactly.
Because this world, the nature of this world is not going to last forever.
So, Sister Zainab, we have it in the Holy Book of Quran that Inna ma'al usri yusra.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to keep, you know, believing in this very verse whenever you are in difficulties. I mean, sometimes these hallucinations get into your mind that maybe I'm an exception. Maybe there is no end to it. Or maybe it's just so far away from me that I cannot tolerate to get to that point.
I think all that starts with the comparison that's in my mind. Maybe things get difficult for me because I am comparing myself with those who have a better life than me. But you don't know everyone around is struggling, everyone around. You know, I just had a conversation with my friends who are living in Dubai. I had conversation with my friends who are living in India. I had conversation with my friends who are living in the UK, who are living in the US. There was no one, I would say, who was entirely happy. You know, sometimes you feel like, okay, someone living in the best part of the world has a better life. Sometimes they face the worst situations. And I think it's all because of these comparisons. All right, Allah had something problem with me. All sadness is written in
my nature.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that when I give you, when I'm generous towards you, when I give for you the blessings, you go into this, you know, thought of yours and you say like, فَيَكُولُ رَبِّي أَكْرَمًا. My Lord, he has honored me.
Mm-hmm.
He has been nice with me, and I deserve this. And then he says that, but whenever I test you by taking away something from you or like, you know, giving you less provision, then you kind of protest and say, my Lord has undeservedly humiliated me.
Yeah.
Well, as he says that, I'm testing you both. Sometimes I'm testing you by giving you something. Sometimes I'm testing you by taking away something from you. You know, both are tests. If I'm confronting some sadness right now, some grief right now, definitely the one I'm in a test. Allah says it's Ibtullah, it's your test.
And it's a constant test, whether it be a blessing or a misery.
It should be understood, blessing is also a test.
Exactly.
This is the point where we fail to understand that the one who has blessing is not being tested.
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Well, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the world is just 2 days. One day that is for you and the other day is the day when you think it's against you. Well, in both days, don't take them so seriously because the days that are for you are not going to last forever. And the day that is not for you and it's actually against you is not going to last forever as well. So this idea must be just carved somewhere in our brain that, okay, I am not going to be in these very situations forever. Life is a short, temporary journey that is not going to be eternal. So whatever of misery and of happiness I'm going through in this world is not going to last forever. But I do believe that as a living, breathing being, it's very difficult sometimes to just believe in all of these things. You know, sometimes we get tired of things very much easily. I mean, in the moment of misery and catastrophes, it's very, very difficult to keep up with the same creed we always had.
You know what? I think sometimes the reason why we feel like so much sad or so much happy about something is the attachment we have to this materialistic exactly. world. And this is a problem. You know, mm-hmm. you chose something wrong to be attached to. And I think it is
now
really...
we should write that with gold. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the wrongest thing we have picked as for
unfortunately
attachment.
And this is not something that we have to blame ourselves for, you know. Mm-hmm. This is the nature of human being, that they are interested in I don't know, materialistic things. This is a part of you, this is part of your nature, but you know, you don't try to control it. Unless you feel the necessity to do that, you know, sometimes
yeah.
The examinations that are in the in your way or the obstacles will force you to do that. But if there is no obstacle, if there is nothing, you don't feel the force to change the source of your attachment. And I think the solution for this disease, it's a disease, I call it a disease, the attachment, the strong
exactly.
attachment we have to this materialistic world. And as you see, the older we get, the more attachment we feel for everything, for money especially.
Yeah.
I see this special greed in old people, which is really interesting for me. Why are you like that? You know, your death is close, you know, sometimes you have a limited time, but you're like, you love your money and you will kill yourself because of that money. Why?
Exactly.
And, you know, this is a concept that I'm understanding more and more when I grow older and more mature, that you know, when you grow old, your attachments are stronger to this materialistic world. And for curing this disease, you have to find the spiritual love, you know, you have to go through that. A spiritual love is something that you have to educate it.
Exactly.
It's not something you can gain it by, I don't know, nature or something. No, you have to go through some speech, some, I don't know, ceremonies, something, whatever, or even reciting the Holy Quran, which is the most beautiful way
exactly.
to do that.
Exactly. That
know?
Is so soothing.
Exactly.
And it would do miracles. And you know what? Just speaking of the
yeah.
transitory nature of the world, I would say that I'm going to add something, but please don't judge me for being a depressed person. I think sometimes visiting cemeteries is going to help you so much, because
exactly.
you would believe that, okay, this is my final resting place. Why do I have to just get sad for something that I know after time it's going to just get solved?
You know, another thing I do for that as a reminder is looking at the page of death you have in your identity card. You know,
yeah,
card.
That also
yeah,
is.
I look at
sometimes
that and,
there
so
are
dark.
People who are not even affected by that.
Yeah.
And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala guides them in Surah Al-Qasr, you know, with the same story that you said, visiting cemeteries. However, Sister Beta was talking about something and this reminded me of Noble Imam Imam Ali alayhi salam, who says that, you know, he writes to Abdullah ibn Abbas, he says, sometimes we feel happy when we get something that we thought we would never get. And we feel sad when we miss out on something that we thought we would always have. But what we should only be happy for the things we have achieved for the afterlife. And we should only be sad for the things we have missed out for the afterlife. We should not be too happy about gaining worldly pleasures, and we should not be too sad about missing them. So
exactly.
again, Imam Ali alayhi salam is giving the criteria of being happy or sad for the things that you have amassed for the afterlife.
And now hearing all of these things and talking about them is very much easier than just practicing them in our life. Adapting them into real life is something difficult that needs practice. So we just have to practice for it every now and then. Right now, let's go for a short break, and then we'll be back in a blink of an eye. So speaking of the sad parts of life, when we get through them, you know, those are the moments when we fail to just be our true selves and to just get the pieces of ourselves together.
Yeah.
Those are very difficult. So if you see someone who's suffering from these sort of experiences, what is the first thing you're going to tell them?
these two shall pass. This is the only thing that I tell to the people who have traumas, you know. And sometimes another thing which is really important here is that to, in order to keep this balance between sadness and happiness, you have to accept the sadness and happiness. Sometimes you are sad, but you don't want to show it. You want to go through a fake happiness by, I don't know, doing drugs, going to parties, talking to people. You do everything not, in order not to feel this sadness.
Yeah, just to distract yourself.
You know, feel it. Sometimes you have to feel it for a short time. Just cry for an hour and it's gonna end. You know, you don't believe it, but it's gonna end. I think sometimes you have to show these feelings of yours to the world, to yourself, and it can be a cure for all of these. And it can have a balance in your life, you know. And these traumas, you know, we have it all. Sometimes you feel like you're so special, and this is really, really harmful and detrimental for you to feel like you're special, you know. You feel like, no, I'm the only miserable person in this world. No, you're not. We have all our own miseries.
We're a big company. You're not alone.
Exactly. You're not alone. That's it.
Yeah.
I think we don't see the beauty behind that. The grief, the sad part of the life is always seen only sad. We don't see the beauty underlying this. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, what you would get in return for your difficult times in the akhirah, when you will see the reward, you will say to yourself, I wish I had scissors and I could, you know, cut myself into the pieces and bear that difficulty if I knew the reward was this. So I think we are unaware of the beauty that lies behind that sorrowful time. We grow, basically. We, in the physical world,
that's
we
the
do
process
grow.
Of growing.
But in the akhirah as well, Allah has something better for us. And as sister said, that this too shall pass, we should always remember this is for this world.
So thank you for staying with us. And thank you, Sister Zainab. Thank you, Sister Bita, until another
session. Thank you for having us.
I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Millions of pilgrims on their way back home after attending Arba'in mourning ceremonies in the Iraqi city of Karbala. The Iraqi government has taken various measures to facilitate their return. And neighboring Iran is also lending a hand, offering special services, not just to Iranian citizens, but to pilgrims from other countries as well. Many of the Iranian mukebs, or tents that were set up to serve the pilgrims across the Arab country, are still there. and Iran's Karbala Consulate Special Arbaeen Section, tasked with helping the pilgrims, will remain operational for another week.
Here at the operation room, we not only give information to the pilgrims, but we also provide them with assistance in case they encounter any problems. There are several committees that follow up on issues that the pilgrims face and contact us for. We are here to offer a helping hand, not just to fellow Iranians, but to pilgrims coming from other countries as well.
For any cross-border traveler, travel insurance is a must, and the Islamic Republic has come up with an innovative solution to help out all pilgrims.
Considering the fact that the Arbaeen Walk is a major international event, we have tried to create an infrastructure to offer travel insurance to non-Iranians as well. And with the database that we have, we will be able to provide even more cost-effective insurance plans for pilgrims next year.
Meanwhile, field hospitals and mobile medical units set up by the Iranian Red Crescent Society remain active until all pilgrims leave, to take care of casualties on site and, if necessary, safely transport them to hospitals.
I had a fever and I wasn't feeling well. An ambulance quickly picked me up and brought me to this medical facility. Everything was free of charge.
My friend wasn't feeling well since yesterday, so as soon as we arrived in Karbala, I brought him here. It was quite easy to find this medical center. It was nearby.
Arbaeen is by far the biggest annual religious gathering in the world. This year, over 22 million people took part.
Over 4 million Iranians crossed the Iran-Iraq border to come to the city of Karbala this year and take part in the Arbaeen ceremonies. Yusuf Shahmadi, Karbala.
There is no end in sight to the suffering of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip amid Tel Aviv's inhumane practices. The Israeli regime has placed a ban on the export of goods from Gaza to the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds since Tuesday, further exacerbating the dire economic situation in the impoverished territory. The Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, has been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007. Israeli security forces claim to have thwarted an attempt to smuggle explosive materials through the crossing on Monday. Observers say the Israeli claim is possibly an excuse for future military aggression against the Gaza Strip.
The impact of the restrictions and the siege is very harsh and very hard against Palestinian people. I think this comes in order to continue this collective punishment against Palestinians who's living in Gaza, and to give Israeli government a justification for any military action.
The Israeli decision to ban exports from Gaza has inflicted heavy losses on the private sector and its various segments. It has deprived businessmen and manufacturers of the ability to market their products, disrupting production and employment.
Stopping exports from the Kerem Shalom crossing has had a grave impact on many factories in Gaza, including my factory. Currently, I'm working with only one-third of my employees because I can't afford to pay salaries. If this catastrophic situation continues, I will lose my business and all my employees will be out of work.
In addition to the ban on exports, the Israeli regime limits the quantity of the goods allowed into the impoverished territory and bans the entry of most raw materials for factories. The Palestinian NGOs Network, which represents over 140 Palestinian civil society organizations, says Tel Aviv's move to ban exports will further complicate living conditions in Gaza. According to officials in Gaza, businesses are losing $500,000 daily because of the export ban. Experts say the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip since 2007 has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and has had grave humanitarian consequences. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Twenty-three-year-old Wazir Azrar arrives at the Federal Agency for Asylum Seekers in Brussels, having been in Belgium for 6 months. Wazir says Western powers destroyed his country, Afghanistan, and now help is not available. Officials at the agency rejected his documents.
I have been waiting for that for 6 months. I've been sleeping on the street, also like in the park. Yeah, this is a big problem here in Belgium for the Afghan refugees and also for the Syrian refugees, you know.
A coach full of families then arrives, and those people are granted access to the asylum application centre. This is because the Belgian government, led by Alexander De Croo, says male refugees travelling alone are no longer welcome in the country.
They're thinking we are just animals and refugees. They don't respect us. That's why I came here. For example, we need like doctors, like these very important things, but they don't care also.
Hundreds of men, mainly from Africa and the Middle East, are sleeping on the streets of Belgium. At the same time, the country is providing full protection to 62,000 Ukrainian refugees. They enjoy the same rights as EU citizens. The European Commission says it is aware of reports that Belgium is rejecting asylum applications from non-Ukrainian single men.
We understand that these are announcements at this stage, so this is still being discussed by the Belgian government, so we will need to see what is exactly happening, and the Commission will be contacting also the Belgian authorities in this respect.
De Croo's administration insists families, women and children must be prioritised as winter approaches. Groups such as Amnesty International claim the Belgian government has reached a new low. They are demanding that authorities here start respecting EU asylum laws and international asylum laws. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Erdogan arrived in Sochi on the eve of the G20 summit. This was his first visit to Russia since his re-election in May. The Turkish official began the meeting with his Russian counterpart by expressing gratitude for Moscow's assistance in extinguishing forest fires and also efforts in eliminating the consequences of a powerful February earthquake. The two sides continued with the topic of the gas hub, which is also their common project. But it was clear that the topic of Ukraine and the grain deal were the main items on the agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the trip.
We are determined to continue efforts to establish lasting peace, stability and prosperity in our region. We previously hosted the direct negotiations between the conflicting parties. As before, we are ready to do our best and act as a mediator.
Erdogan arrived on the eve of the G20 summit in New Delhi. Therefore, the issue of the grain deal was also raised, from which Russia withdrew, since not a single promise given by the Western partners was fulfilled. Putin noted that the withdrawal of Russia does not affect the food crisis. In addition, Russia is ready to come up with several initiatives at once.
We intend to organize the supply of 1 million tons of grain from Russia at a preferential price for processing to Turkey and then free transportation to the poor countries. In this sense, we count on the help from the Qatari state, who is ready to support the poorest countries for humanitarian reasons.
According to the Russian leader, the initiative is not a replacement for the grain deal, but would make a great contribution to solving the food problem in the African countries. The visit by the Turkish president turned out to be quite short, just a few hours, and no documents were signed.
Turkey's hopes to extend the grain deal did not come true. However, Moscow and Ankara are already engaged in several joint projects. Russia is building the Akuyu nuclear power plant, and the state of the gas hub, which diversifies Russian gas supplies to Europe, also depends on Moscow. Russia is actively supporting Turkey in various sectors of the national economy, ranging from banking to metallurgy. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Tensions remain high in Sweden after the Holy Quran was desecrated in the city of Malmö on Sunday. A notorious Iraqi hate preacher has been attacking Islam's holy text on a routine basis for weeks. His antics led to an angry response as 15 people were arrested following confrontations with the police. Police provided protection for the offensive action and even arrested some Muslims who tried to save the Quran from the flames. Cities up and down Sweden are all being affected by these anti-Islam incidents. This mosque in central Stockholm has routinely been the victim of Quran desecration antics, many of which have been taking place right outside their front doorsteps and with police protection at that. The Muslim world has responded angrily, trying to pressure the Swedish authorities to curb this rising trend in Islamophobic stunts. A local Swedish Muslim activist explained how the government's defense of hate speech is costing Sweden dearly.
Almost majority of Swedish people, they don't like these actions, you know, because this will destroy Swedish reputation in the world. And this kind of acts may hurt milliards of Muslims all over the world. So to let this thing just happen in this country, we almost see the Finland, like for example, and even Denmark right now, they are studying the things that they will prohibit the burning of Quran. So why cannot Sweden do that?
Though acknowledging that these acts hurt Sweden's image and put its security at risk, the authorities here have shown no concrete signs of changing the laws to protect Muslims from hate preachers. Swedish security services have also admitted the country's security situation has deteriorated following the Quran burnings. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
People from all walks of life march several kilometers in the sun, converging on the Suleja town. Throughout their trek, they engage in mourning and vehemently denounce the brutal murder of Imam Hussein, his family members, and his steadfast companions. Groups of people standing by the roadside offered weary trekkers food and juice along the route of the long walk. The participants in the procession say they continue to grieve even 40 days after the anniversary of Imam Hussein's martyrdom.
As we came out today, massively in commemorating, showing a solidarity, showing a love and a condolence for the killing of his grandson, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Aba Abdullah, which is the savior of Islam. If not Imam Hussein, Islam could have been another story.
A procession of marchers weave through the streets of Suleja and gathered in a designated location to engage in prayers dedicated to Imam Hussein and those who were martyred with him. The marchers emphasize the enduring legacy of Imam Hussein's martyrdom, underscoring its continued significance and relevance to present-day global issues.
His actions 1,400 years back are something to be emulated and something that will never be forgotten, and something as far as this world exists, the name of Imam Husseini and the actions he took against tyrant Yazid will never be forgotten.
The participants in the march here say it is another act of mourning for the pain of Imam Hussein during the incidents that led to his martyrdom and the martyrdom of his family members and companions in the Battle of Karbala. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Men and women, young and old, clad in black, marching to the Iraqi city of Karbala to pay tribute and renew their allegiance to Imam Hussein, who is the all-time symbol of fighting injustice, oppression, and despotism. The annual Arba'in March, which is the world's largest religious gathering, brings together millions of pilgrims here. They take the long walk 40 days after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, Prophet Muhammad's grandson, who was martyred along with 72 of his companions during the Battle of Karbala.
As we get closer to the city of Karbala, more people are joining the Arba'in walk, hoping to get there in time for the Arba'in processions.
Tents and special stands called mukib are set up on the path leading to the city to provide pilgrims with free food and other necessities, making this journey even more special.
Iraq is considered a holy land for us Muslims. This is why it brings people from all walks of life together. The Arbaeen pilgrimage is, more than anything, a show of solidarity among Muslims. The pilgrimage that is as much about community as it is about religion. That is why it sends such a strong message.
Aside from pilgrims coming from countries including Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Azerbaijan, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia, the presence of Palestinian pilgrims and their special mukib speaks more than a thousand words.
This is a very important occasion, and Imam Hussein is a figure that inspires all freedom fighters in the world, particularly us in Palestine. That is why we are here, not just to take part in the Arbaeen Walk, but also to serve those who are on their way to Karbala.
As Muslims, we are one. There is no difference between us, especially on this occasion and when it comes to Imam Hussein's teachings. However, our enemies, the United States and the Israeli regime, try very hard to divide us. But as you can see here, we are also part of this amazing journey to Karbala. We also take pride in serving the lovers of Imam Hussein because he is our role model and his path is the path that leads to the freedom of Al-Quds.
During the mass prayers, this is exactly what the pilgrims put on display. While crying solidarity every step of the way from Najaf to Karbala. Gisumi Shahmadi, Haydariya.